Welcome to the Two Writing Teachers podcast. Two Writing Teachers is a meeting place for a world of reflective writers. Here on the podcast, we are excited to talk about ways to create, lead, and sustain joyful and productive writing workshops. My name is Stacey Schubitz, and I'm here with my colleague Melanie Meehan. Let's work together to inspire and empower students to be competent, brave, and confident writers. Welcome back, listeners. Today is a new type of long-form segment of the Two Writing Teachers podcast. I'm excited to introduce the Writing Roundtable. In these episodes, Melanie and I will dive deep into aspects of writing with guest authors. Today marks our inaugural roundtable discussion, setting the stage for a handful of these insightful conversations each season. Without further ado, I want to welcome today's first guest and begin our exploration of poetry. Hi, Amy.
Hi there. I'm so happy to be here at Two Writing Teachers.
I'm delighted that you are here today. Melanie wanted to be here so badly. We had some scheduling snafus on our end, and I did not want to delay our conversation. So thank you for coming on. And please know Melanie wishes she could have been here today. May I introduce you to our listeners?
Thank you. Yes.
Amy Ludwig Vanderwater is a children's author, poet, and writing teacher celebrated for her contributions to children's literature and poetry education. A contributor to many anthologies, she has also authored several children's books of her own, including Forest Has a Song, The Sound of Kindness, With My Hands, Poems About Making Things, and Read, Read, Read. Additionally, she teaches teachers about writing and is the author of Poems Are Teachers, How Studying Poetry Strengthens Writing in All Genres. You may know Amy from her personal blog, The Poem Farm. From 2010 to 2011, in this space, she wrote and published a new poem and lesson each day for 365 consecutive days, profoundly affecting her writing life. She continues to post at The Poem Farm on Fridays and each day every April, making it a treasure trove for teachers filled with poems, ideas, and lessons. During the COVID pandemic, Amy recorded 72 writer's notebook lessons for teachers and students at another blog, Sharing Our Notebooks. Along with her writing and teaching, Amy has a deep passion for reading, making things with her hands, and spending time outdoors. She lives in Holland, New York, and now writes in Gratitude, the yellow writing shed, as well as on the hardwood floor by the heater of her living room. So, Amy, you are so impressive, and I am delighted to say that I have known you for about 14 years now, way back to NCTE in 2010. I remember meeting you, and it's just, I know, I can't believe it, right? It's been a minute. It's been a minute. I've had like a human go from my abdomen to teenage years in that time.
Crazy. And fine, we're teenage years and now gone off in the world. So and here we are.
They have launched and here we are. I mentioned in your intro that you had these lessons, these Sharing Our Notebook lessons during COVID. And you know this, and our listeners don't. I took advantage of those with my daughter, Isabel, who was home. I was recuperating from some foot surgery and I was stuck in bed. And I was like, these lessons are great. They were such a gift. And they were done in Betsy the Writing Camper. What happened to Betsy before we begin this whole podcast?
Betsy found a new family. I went through a series of vintage campers. It was sort of my vintage camper era. But Betsy lasted the longest. And it was a lot of fun to post those videos out there. I also needed something to do during COVID because I could not visit schools. And I knew that teachers were alone and in the classroom and or home. And so that just was a little offering I made for them and also for me.
It was a huge offering, and I remember watching them sometimes with tears in my eyes, thinking, if there are children who are at home who don't have a caregiver alongside them because they're at work or they're sick, it was like such a comforting video and a comforting presence that you offered. And they're still out there, correct?
They are still out there, and it's kind of funny. I've heard from people in the, you know, still every once in a while who said, oh, I listened to that with those with my teenagers or my little daughter. She wrote from those videos. And, you know, I kind of really just want to be Mr. Rogers. So they
I was going to compare you to Mr. Rogers, and I was saying, is she going to work better?
That's why
not?
I did like the blow a kiss and a high five. You know, I think community we all needed then and we need now.
Yes.
And that writing is something that can give us that. And even when we're not in the same place, we can be reminded that we can still be in the same place in a different way.
Yes, they were beautiful. And for any Thank listener you. Who does not know them, I will link to them in the show notes because you should know them. You should know those.
They're a little
videos.
Dorky, but they were a lot of fun.
Listen, 5 years later, they're still a treasure. And they were great. They saved our lives in this house. So I appreciate it tenfold.
Thank you, Stacey.
Let me get to some questions. The reason that Melanie and I wanted to have you on today is because we want to get teachers ready for National Poetry Month. That's why this episode is coming prior to National Poetry Month, so that teachers can gear up for it. As much as we at Two Writing Teachers feel that poetry should be taught year round, and I know that you believe that, in many places, it just is not happening. So in an effort to honor the fact that it may not be happening and this might be people's only opportunity, we wanted to give them the opportunity to hear from a living, breathing poet and educator about this. So I have some questions for you, and I'll dive into my first one right now. Let's start with this. Could you discuss the critical role of poetry in children's cognitive, emotional, and creative development? And also along with that, what unique benefits does poetry offer to young learners?
Poems are short. So there's that, right? It's not difficult to find your way into a poem. It doesn't take a long time. Poems can be read aloud. They're playful oftentimes. There's a lot of wordplay. And there really is a poem to match every emotion, every experience. And poetry brings a lot of joy, just the clapping along, just the singing. You know, poems are songs without without the music. I do have a friend named Gart in Japan who regularly pulls my Poem Farm poem and sets it to music and plays it back to me on the piano. Yeah, and then I go back and add them in. So there's a lot of joy in poetry, and a poem can tell a story, express an opinion, teach information. A poem can describe a scene, delve into emotion, or just play with words. And so when we look at poetry, Katie Ray used to say that a picture book is just a container. It can hold nonfiction, or it can hold a narrative, and a poem is the same. A poem is not one type of writing. It's just a short looking amount of lines on a page that could hold any type of writing. So it's a container, just like a picture book, but a smaller container. And our brains and our souls and our hearts, we need all of these different kinds of writing. And because poems are small, poems are a good, comfy fit for any day, any time of the day. And like all literature, poetry helps us feel not alone.
It really does. I remember disliking poetry as a child because I thought it all had to rhyme, and I wasn't very good at rhyming. And as a teacher, my first year of teaching, I learned that was not the case. And I learned how beautiful poetry was and how accessible it was to me once I found more books of poetry, and how accessible it was to my students. So how do you think it impacts like kids' creative development to read a lot of poems?
Like all writing, when we read a lot of a certain type of writing, that the rhythms of that type of writing become a part of us. They become a part of the kind of writing that we're then able to make. And so hearing lots of poems and reading many poems offers students all kinds of possibilities for how their own poems might sound or mean or feel. Mm-hmm. And because a poem isn't right or wrong, there's a freedom in writing poetry that it doesn't have to rhyme. It doesn't have to have a certain amount of lines. You're making these choices. And while I wouldn't say that if you put 10 poems in front of me, I wouldn't have preferences and I would say, oh, they're all equally likable. But I think also because poems are short for me, I can write a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And then I can have 10 and I can say, I like these 2 and I don't like these 8. And it's not writing a novel. So
Correct.
There's less of a fear approach. But I do think that for many of us who had experiences with poetry that were how shall I say it, where poetry was couched in mysterious, ununderstandable terms. Poetry has created fear for some teachers and some adults who say, I don't like it. I'm scared of it. I don't get it. Like it's obtuse. But there are so many poems out there that just, you think, I could have written that. Like, I mean, I'm not as good enough a writer to write that, but that emotion, that's me. I understand the heart to heart with those words on that page.
Absolutely. So thinking about practical strategies, what practical strategies for introducing and celebrating poetry do you think that educators can use if they're looking to integrate poetry a bit more meaningfully into their classroom culture?
I would keep it very simple, right? Because practical strategies, school days are busy, they're hectic, there are so many decisions that teachers are making. So something very simple that one can do is to simply read a poem aloud here and there, maybe mm-hmm. at a certain time of day. So we begin the day by reading a poem aloud, and maybe it's a different poem. And it may be, I just, as a teacher, have a good anthology and I open it up to the next page. I don't have to make it match the curriculum. Sure, I can, but right. I could just open up to the next page. Rebecca Dotlich, who is a wonderful children's poet, mm-hmm. she has told the story about how her high school English teacher would just start the day by reading a poem out loud and then would go right into the lesson. And she said, we'd look at each other like, what is going on? We thought it was so strange. But mm-hmm. very quickly, Rebecca says, we would come to look forward to what the poem would be. Oh, and wow. So it's just like a one more stone in the lake of literature, right? That we can toss in there. So, and if I wanted to, it could be the same poem every day for a week. So when I went back to the classroom during COVID, I went back and taught fourth grade during COVID for a year. Mm-hmm. I did a very simple thing, and I can give you a link for the show notes if you'd like. Yes. That details it. But I chose a poem of the week and students copied it. We read it aloud every day and I would read it aloud and then we would read it aloud together. And by day three, students would say, May I read it aloud? Can I close my eyes? And by the end of the week, most of us had each of those poems memorized. And by the end of the year, because we would repeat some of the poems, the last day I had four sections of ELA. Mm-hmm. My student said, on the last day, could we just read all the poems out loud that we learned all year? And that's what we did. We just read aloud all 36 poems of that year. And they had them all hand copied into their little book. And it was very simple. And it was a ritual. It was a structure. It was a routine. And it was the same every time. And I think that predictability and that practicality and that haven of that notebook was a comfort to all of us during that time.
Absolutely. And what a beautiful treasure they have as they go through life and they can look back on that beautiful notebook, because I would venture to guess that they saved that. That was not going into the rubbish bin.
I hope not. And the other thing is you create community very quickly by reading poems together.
Yes.
Some are funny and some are serious and some are sad. And one of them we did was a poem called Something Told the Wild Geese. And I apologize for not remembering the poet's name. I'll send it to you for the show notes. But okay. It also can be sung. And we learned it and then I played the song. And one boy in my class said, may I sing it? And he stood up and sang that poem to the class. And it was just, you know, those moments you have as a teacher. Mm-hmm. But through poetry, I didn't have to write it. I didn't plan it. You know, they were just, again, offerings of beautiful words by beautiful people that I don't know.
I need to write that down. Offerings of, and yes, I'm literally writing this down. Beautiful words by beautiful people.
Yeah, that none of us knew in person.
Okay, now that I've written that down, that'll probably appear in the episode description. So let's go and just shift gears a little bit. You've written a lot of different type of things. Like, you're a very versatile author. So how do you navigate the distinct writing styles required for writing professional books for teachers versus picture books and anthologies? And are there any specific strategies that you employ to transfer between these different modes of writing?
This is a great question, and it's a little bit of an embarrassing answer. So I am not a very strategic person.
Okay.
And I'm going to ask your listeners and you to think about this question. So somebody once said to me in some workshop, I don't remember, that each person has an internal age. And no matter how old you are, inside yourself, you feel like, I am really this age. So when you were young, you were an old soul. When you're older, do you know, you maybe were a young soul. And we all can think of people we know, right? But we also, when we honestly ask ourselves this question, we can know that number.
Okay.
Or close to it. Mm-hmm. So if you want to tell yours, you can. But
I feel like I'm still 30.
Right?
I want to still be 30.
Did you just know? Right away?
Yes.
What was the number?
Yes, because when I think back to the best year of my life, and this makes my kids so angry, it was 2007. It was a really hard year, but it was also a great year teaching, working in New York City. I was engaged to be married. I later got married. I also had neurosurgery and lost my grandmother that year. But even with those, like, valleys, the highs were so good. So yes, 30. What's yours?
30. 8. Tell me more. So like as an inner 8-year-old, I'm not saying like, how am I going to craft this professional book for teachers, right? Because I'm not a teacher, like I'm a kid. So what's it, but I do think, and sometimes things take a little while. So I would say the work at the Poem Farm and most of my work with teachers around poetry has been a marriage of, I was at the Teachers College Reading Writing Project when Katie Wood Ray was there. So in the 90s, when she had just written Wondrous Words. Wow. So I was at a workshop where we all got a copy of that. We were the first people to get a copy of that. And I had to read it a few times because it really was an enormous, I mean, I read it's well, but that book really changed how I thought about a lot of things. And Poems Are Teachers is really Wondrous Words with poetry. And Katie was the editor on that. And she knows that. Like I learned from her. And then Lee Bennett Hopkins was a writing mentor for me. So what I learned about poetry and what I learned about reading like a writer, those two things came together. But because it took me a few times to read that book, and because I came to teaching writing through doing a lot of my own writing and really doing myself the same lessons that show up in books for children, right? Like books for professional books for teachers about teaching writing. I would do those same lessons myself as if, you know, not pretending to be young, but honestly doing them because strong writing, books about strong writing with good lessons are true no matter how old you are. So writing strong narrative, if you're reading a book about writing narrative in grade 2, and those are honest, true lessons about writing narrative. They will help you when you're 20 or 30 or 55.
I
totally narrative is narrative.
Correct.
It's not just like a little thing we make cute to be in third grade. Like if you're learning about writing poetry, honestly, in fourth grade from a teacher who understands poetry, loves you, those same strategies will stay with you when you're in the nursing home writing poetry because it's the same, because it's still poetry. It's not like there's poetry for little ones and that, you know, you get older, so your sensitivities change and you're able to count syllables more accurately or whatever. But poetry is poetry. So I would say because...
And good teaching is good teaching. Because if you're teaching it really well when someone is young, those lessons really do stick and they do go in that writer's toolbox or that poetry toolbox.
Absolutely, they do. And so as a teacher, I think sometimes we can think, I have thought that I teach this now and then it's gone, but it really is like you plant a seed and then it gets watered more by the next teacher and watered more by the next teacher. But an understanding of writing, if I move from grade to grade as a teacher, it doesn't change really what the qualities of strong opinion writing are. You know, they become more deep as students get older. But so because I am aware of how it took me a while. I read Wondrous Words a few times. I think one thing that I am able to do is approach things with a beginner's mind. I really don't feel like, oh, I've got this at all. So when I wrote Poems Are Teachers, I wrote it with that same curiosity and remembering learning how to read like a writer. So I think when I talk to students and when I talk to teachers, it's pretty much the same. Like I don't, So I don't feel that I changed the strategy a lot. Now, however, with writing a professional book, which is not exactly my great skill set, because it's a lot of papers. I mean, it's a lot of pages. It's not mm-hmm. one poem. You have to have an outline and chapters and all those things. So thank goodness my daughter Georgia was in high school at the time. And so I hired her to do some of the organization of permissions and papers. You know, there does have to be a long-term strategy. But with a poem, for me, what's different, I would say, is that I do, there's like a more mysterious, of course, mysterious things show up and you surprise yourself on the page with a longer professional text. But with poetry, I think for me anyway, there is more of a mystical sort of magic that I write something and once in a while I say, wow, I have no idea where that came from. Like, it's a complete surprise. And so I think that's why I like to write, not really because of things getting published. I don't really care about things getting published. It's fun, but I like the surprise. This is why I don't use AI in my writing, because I would like the ideas to surprise me in my own brain and not to be generated by a large processor somewhere and fed to me. Right. I love the connections that grow from an organic brain and heart in writing. And I want children to feel those same connections.
And they will. If we teach them the ways that AI can help, great, but we're not using it as the writing generator. I know people are talking about that. I think that writing still needs to come from us.
Humans. Yeah, there's a book coming out by John Warner I'm excited about related to this. And I think thinking about AI as a writing teacher changes the whole game with writing. So part of it, I believe, relates to whether as a teacher, I believe that writing is about a process or a product. Mm-hmm. And if I honor the process primarily, then we go without it for quite a while so that students are able to experience that process purely.
Yeah. Purely. Right. Right. I'm still kind of like one of those people who thinks that writing on paper with pens and pencils is a good idea. Not because I'm archaic. I mean, I have all the technology. I like my technology, but I really think that we need to be on paper and in notebooks more than we need to be on these tablets.
I agree.
I worry about kids. I say, I mean, I'm looking at you with my reading glasses that are also blue light glasses on. I mean, it's a real issue from that standpoint, but just that tactile sensation. And I just think that there's so much that really still requires us to put pen to page.
I agree. And I think also because when we make, as just humans, as we are animals, as human beings, as animals, we are tool users. We make things, right? When I knit a pair of socks, I look at them. I say, wow, I made that with my hands. I baked that loaf of bread with my hands. And when you write something by hand, you have a different relationship to what it is that you made. And I think there's a value for humans in knowing I don't need to be plugged in. I don't need to have the internet. I don't need to have Google. Like, I can sit here alone in this meadow with this notebook and make something.
Yes.
And that is being lost. And that is a shame.
I want to pause here because I want our listeners to think about that. We'll be right back.
When Stacy and I first started our podcast, we researched various platforms and we made the great decision to use Zencastr for our recording. We've been really happy with this decision because, for one, it's super easy to record a podcaster with Zencastr. We can log in using our browsers and start recording a high-quality podcast right away. There have been a couple times when we've had unstable internet and Zencastr has multi-layered backups that keep the recordings in the highest quality. A very relieving feature. With many different features and services, if you have thought about podcasting before and realize that you need a lot of different tools, those days are over. With Zencastr's all-in-one podcasting platform, you can create your podcast all in one place and distribute to Spotify, Apple, and other major destinations. To get started, go to zencastr.com/pricing and use our code TWTPOD. you'll get 30% off your first month of any Zencastr paid plan. We want you to have the same easy experiences we do for all our podcasting and content needs. It's time to share your story.
And we are back. Amy, I want to switch gears a little bit. I'm going to ask you a question that might sound a little bit like which one of your children's your favorite, but you don't have to answer that. Among the books you've authored, which one holds a special place in your creative journey? And are there any particular works, be it poems or books, or websites that you feel incredibly proud of or that represent a significant milestone in your writing career?
Ooh, it's a tricky question. I am terrible at favorites, so let that be known. I have no favorite anythings, really. But I will say this, Lee Bennett Hopkins, who was and remains the, you know, world's most published children's poetry anthologist. He was in the Guinness Book of World Records for having, like, yeah. I don't know, maybe 121 books when he died. He used to tell me, always think about what your next project is. Don't hold on to your old ones. Think about your next one. And that is helpful to me because for me, the things that I write, it is sort of strange. They feel like they were written by past people. You know how they talk about you're like Russian nesting dolls inside yourself or whatever. When I write something, it is pretty much gone. And with hundreds and thousands probably of poems at the poem farm, I don't remember them. Like when I write them, they're gone. And sometimes someone shares one with me and says, oh, I liked this one from 2011 or whatever. And I say, I didn't write that. And they say, oh, no, you did write this. But they are completely gone for me. So I say to children, and it is true that what I love, the one I love the most is this here blank page right here, because I don't know what's going to be there. And what I love is the not knowing and then the leap to the knowing. That said, of course, yes, I am very pleased with the fact that I kept up a habit of writing a poem a day at the poem farm for a whole year. And that was because I had seen the movie Julie and Julia about the woman who cooked you know, who cooked like a French dish every day. Like Julia Child. So that inspired me to do that. And then I'm there every Friday. So that sort of stick-to-itiveness is not always a hallmark of my personality. So I'm really happy I stayed there. It's allowed me to connect with lots of people, like the friend I mentioned in Japan, people really all over the world who ask, could we put this poem on our Meals and Wheels tray? Or would you mind if we read this at a Memorial Day ceremony? Or like, or I'm a high school student in Zimbabwe and we'd like to put this in our yearbook. And that to me, like, that's I feel so grateful. Yes. Connect with all these free uses of these poems. All that said, I feel lucky to have written these books. I just feel like I got to be there for the writing of them. Like I played a hand in the writing of those books. And read, and write are a pair illustrated by the same illustrator, Ryan O'Rourke. And I'm happy I have this pair of books that really does marry, again, my work as a writing teacher and a mom wanting my children to love reading with being a person who writes poems for children. And so many people writing poetry today for children can thank him. And I started doing this because I went up to him after a talk he gave at a conference and asked him, you know, I write poems for children, which was somewhat of a half truth at the time. Like aspirationally, I wanted to. And he said, oh, here, just send them to me. And he gave me a snail mail address. And I did and ended up connecting with him. And so, yeah, he had very strong, generous shoulders.
Yes. I mean, when I think about like words that come to mind about Lee Bennett Hopkins, besides being enormously talented and a gifted poet, just generosity. I remember like this big celebration at NCTE one year. I think it was like, I don't remember which year it was, but it was like everyone was there to celebrate him. And like, he always called people dear one.
He did, and everybody thought they were the only one.
Yes.
And when he passed, I actually went, I have one tattoo, and I went, my daughter came with me, and on my right forearm, it says "Good Books, Good Times." LBH. That was the title of a book of his I loved when I taught fifth grade back, you know, when I was in my 20s, and I just felt like I wanted to look down and always remember how generous he was, because really, that is it—the name of the game in all of this work—is how can we be generous?
Yes. And you are incredibly generous with what you give on your site. And I think it's just really remarkable in a day that so many people are putting things on Teachers Pay Teachers and other sites. That's not you. And I really notice that and appreciate that, because I think that that really matters when we want to get things that are high quality into people's hands. We shouldn't always have to charge them for it. So thank you for that. I want to talk a little bit more about your anthology career, because you, as you just said, you went up to him and spoke to Lee Bennett Hopkins, and you have successfully navigated this world of poetry anthologies. I know a lot of listeners of this podcast write poems, and I'm sure they're wondering, how do I get my poems into an anthology? So can you share a little bit of your insight from this journey? Like, what were the key steps, besides going up to him at the conference, because obviously no one can do that at this point. What were the key steps in establishing yourself in that market or in that place? I don't know if it's called a market.
Yeah, market, I think, works. Well, I'm not really a business person. So I love writing. I love the act of writing. And so this remains a challenge for me. I did show up. I spoke with Lee. I was pregnant. I had a baby at home. He gave me his address. I sent him a bunch of poems. He wrote back, again, snail mail, saying, I'll keep this in my file. Maybe I'll ask you to write in an anthology sometime. A year later, he did. Had one poem accepted by him. And then at that time, I was lucky to be on his list of what he called takeout poets. So he'd say, I'm doing a book on all the wars America's ever fought in. See if you can write a poem. And if I pick it, you know, that's kind of how that went. So, and then after time, he was willing to read Forest Has a Song. So, and connected me with his agent, who has since been my agent since 2006.
Amazing.
But I think I was very lucky. So that... True, because I was lucky to be in his workshop. I was lucky I felt brave to go up and talk to him. I was lucky he was generous. I was lucky. And I also worked very hard and I was very humble. I think it's easy. And I think there have been many times when I've thought my writing is better, has been better than it actually is or was. And so there is, I think, there's wanting to write and there's wanting to be published. And I think they're two really different things. And Lee helped me understand that just because I wrote something, it didn't mean it was good, that I have to learn from other people and be good with that and be humble and accept rejection and not expect that people are going to want to help me just because I want help. And so that I would say... Finding, going to workshops is good. Joining SCBWI, which is the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. I can send you the link.
No, I know it because I am part of it, or I was. That's a whole other
story. There are local
I just
groups.
Gave up doing that type of writing. But
There are local groups.
Yes.
I think there's a lot offered out there. I think one can expect that everyone is going to be likely, because it is one thing to be a writer or to be published. It's another thing to be a mentor like he was. He had a lot of tremendous gifts. But you can take classes at the Highlights Foundation about writing for children. But I think if you love writing, as I love writing, I hope, yes, I understand the desire to get published. And yet, at the same time, I did think everything would be so different when I was published and that first book came out. It's not really.
No.
Like, it was great and it's nice to have it. And if I don't lose it, I'll pass it down to my kids. You know, I don't have lots of copies of all my books or anything, but I like that I write and that is part of who I am and it's made me who I am. So another thing I would recommend to people, a lot of people say, you put these poems on the poem farm. That's free. Like, people could steal them from you. People could whatever, get ideas from. And I don't care. Like, that's okay. Like, I want to share them. Certainly, yes, I may have been ripped off left and right. Some people ask, can I put your poem in my Teachers Pay Teachers unit? And I say, no, I'm sorry. I'm not getting money for that. So, you know, I respect that that's a you know, a way other people make money. But since I'm not making money from this poem, I don't really feel comfortable
having
other people making money from this poem. But some people probably don't ask. And so but that's whatever. Who cares? Do you know, I get to live one time. So I just think being generous, if you're a person who likes to write, share your writing with other people. And I do think probably many of the opportunities that I've been fortunate enough to have are because of the poem form more than because of any of my books.
I get that. I mean,
because
first of all,
it's very steady. It's, I don't make a lot of money from poetry books. Who does? I mean, some people do, but I'm not one of them. But with the poem form, it's a steady presence online. I'm very predictable. I'm dependable. I'm wholesome. There's no ads. There's no AI. I'm a safe person in your classroom. And so to me, I gain as much from that as I give. I get to connect
totally
with students
that.
And teachers.
Right. And those connections are real. I mean, at Two Writing Teachers, we are the same way as the poem form. The blog has never accepted any form of advertising. Ever. It never will either. We have never been an affiliate for that large book company that many people are.
Right.
Like if you're going to click on a link to download it, it's going to pop up on your computer. You're not going to be asked to pay us. And I feel like that generosity just needs to be there. And I really appreciate that about you because that's how we're going to all grow as educators. And
we just need each other. And so if I have something, it's like stone soup, right? If I have something, I'll come throw it in your pot. You can throw something in my pot. And certainly I do school visits. I earn money doing that. Like, of course. I mean, it's not like I eat air. But that said, I think you do. It is different in community. And I did not plan that with the poem farm. It was a very fortunate, serendipitous community I was able to make there.
And you've curated something beautiful. I want to just, before I ask you my next question, I want to recommend a book to people who are listening to this, who are like, well, Lee Bennett Hopkins is gone. Who is that person going to be? Ina Garten, otherwise known as the Barefoot Contessa, recently published a memoir called Be There When the Luck Happens. And a lot of the things that have happened in life, she has felt that have been just, she's been in the right place at the right time and it's been lucky, but she has worked so hard for it. So for anyone who's thinking, how do I get into this? How do I move forward? I think that might be a really good audiobook to listen to. It might really inspire you alongside of what Amy is saying and help you kind of figure out your next steps. And of course, join SCBWI, try and take a course at the Highlights Foundation. I highly suggest that book. So moving
Thank
on.
You. I will read that too. My mom loved that book.
It was one of my favorite audiobook reads of the year last year. It was phenomenal. I loved it. She also taught me how to cook when I first moved into a house and had like a kitchen that was big enough to cook in.
I'm going
to
get my Lippy app right now.
Yes. Yes, you should. It's wonderful. So what advice would you offer someone who's an aspiring poet or an aspiring children's book writer seeking publication besides SCBWI and doing those types of things? Like what kind of like practical, like at home, doesn't cost a lot of money advice would you suggest?
Yes. Well, I guess it depends, on the question, which is, do you want to write or do you want to get published or do you want both? I do not analyze the market. I write nature poems, kind of quiet poems. You know, I don't write the thing that gets published a lot. So I'm not a person to ask about how do you analyze the market. And no, I know I do know that people, there are lots of people who are very successful at if you know the kind of thing you like to write, you find the books in the library that are like the kinds of books that you want to write. And you read them and you figure out what publishers publish those books that I am interested in, you know, joining ranks of. There's a book called The Market Guide to, or used to be, writing children's books. And that was is a good resource. They have interviews with agents and interviews with editors and tips of things not to say, like my daughter loved my story or my husband illustrated this, you know, things that I wouldn't have known if I hadn't read those. So there are those sort of practical entering the world tips. But there's also the truth of knowing what is it
that I have to offer or have to say. And one might not even know what that is.
Yeah.
Until one sits down and writes, and then it reveals itself. So I find trying to analyze the market and guess and hope is just not a game I'm personally interested in playing. I think it can work, and I might have more published books if I was had my head in that game, but I don't. But it is two separate things. Submitting your work and trying to get it published is really different than writing. It's a different job.
It is a different job.
And so
you have to be patient.
Some people are really good at both jobs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really good at both jobs. I have an agent who's really good at that second job, but I'm not, you know, always productive enough to get things to her, right? So it's you do have to look inward and ask, well, you know, there's a lot of value in writing things that don't end up in the greater world.
Yes, I will say I am at the very tail end of my manuscript for my forthcoming book. And the other day I found a file that contained all of these little vignettes that I had written. There's not a single one in the book. I just wrote them at the time. I was like needing to write them and they didn't go anywhere. And I'm okay with that. I'm not sitting here angry. It's more like, what's this? It's like the $20 bill in your pocket.
And they did go somewhere because you don't know how they led to what ended up in the book. It may not be those exact words, but they were perhaps the foundation that needed to have been written for you to write the thing you wrote in chapter 7 that wouldn't have appeared had you not done that work that's in that folder now.
100%. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. So in the spirit of Lee Bennett Hopkins saying, think about your next project, can you tell me what you are working on as a writer?
I'm not working on a project for publication right now. So I'm writing for myself right now as a writer. And I do the poem form does keep me honest. It does keep me there on a Friday. It sort of nails my feet to the ground on a Friday, as terrible of an image as that is. It helps to have an audience. That's another thing about blogging that can be helpful. Mm-hmm. You have a forced audience. So you have to do the project. If you promise people you'll be there,
you know,
a blog makes you do the writing. I do have a book coming out at some point. I sold it before the pandemic. It was based on one of my April. So most every April, except for one since 2010, I do a poem every day. I do a project sort of in real time for students to see. And one I did was a picture book, sort of like, I guess I'd call it like a poetry picture book, like a, of a story. It's a narrative, but in poems called John and Betsy, about a boy who is unable to keep his dog because his family can't afford it, and the woman who adopts the dog, and how they end up meeting in a park. And it's I did 30 poems in an April in 2012, I want to say. It sold way later than that. It may not have been 2012. The project's different every year. And I every day just wrote a new poem in this story, and I had no idea where it would go. I had no, my mom had adopted a dog from a shelter, and the dog was there because the family could not afford the dog. And that image just really stayed with me. And I just followed the imaginary trail of that story. And so that will be coming out. They're looking for an illustrator. People wanting to publish should know that sometimes a book, Forest Has a Song, I sold in 2006. It was published in 2013. So sometimes we get the lessons that we need in life. And I'm not a very patient person. So I have had to learn. I say to students, I can't call up a publisher and say, why has it been 5 years? You know, it, nobody wants to be asked that question. So that's why we work on the next project, whether it's something we plan to share with somebody else or something that we just want to keep for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yes. My children are like, oh, so what are you doing next? And I start talking. I'm like, I'm percolating these ideas, but like, no, I'm not like pitching another book next. Like, I just need to do some other writing. I just want to put myself down and write.
Yeah. And see what it'll be.
See what it'll be and see where it takes you. So I have a final question for you as we wrap up. As an author and a poet, what hopes and dreams do you have for young children's engagement with reading and writing?
I love this question.
Thanks. I will tell you, this comes from Melanie, not me. I think she said it and I was like, let's use the word like hopes and dreams, or maybe she said hopes and dreams and I said, let's put this at the end of every episode. So like this is really like our way of sending off, what's your hope for the future? And I thought that it was a beautiful question, so I'll take no credit for it. Go on.
It is a beautiful question. And I think it's also, it translates beautifully for those of us who also teach. So for teachers to say, what are the hopes and dreams I have for the young children in my classroom? Mm-hmm. That's a really important question. I think having answering a question like that for ourselves helps us teach in daily ways that match our vision. And so as a writer whose writing sometimes meets 8-year-olds and sometimes meets grown-ups who feel like 8-year-olds, my dream is really that children and adults, children of every age, will have opportunities to find meaning in their lives, be it through poetry or nonfiction or stories or visual arts, music, theater, dance, whatever arts they are, and that these children of any age will find and have the opportunities to discover the joy and the surprise that comes from creating something new, and that art will help them stay warm in the cold.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful.
And I actually have a poem. May I just read you
Please.
This poem?
Please, that would be a great way to send off.
This is from Right. You know, we talk about power in a lot of different ways, and sometimes power doesn't really echo outward, and we aren't changing other people and making things happen to mm-hmm. other people, but that we can have an inner power that we've grown or we've changed because of something we've made or done. Mm-hmm. And writing is something that whether anybody else reads it or not, I can still have a certain through line of power inside myself, and maybe that will help me make decisions differently or help me treat people differently because I wrote about it and I've made decisions through my writing. So this is a poem, a little poem called Timeline. Mm-hmm. I was a new writer, just learning how. I scribbled, I drew, I listened. Then, wow, I sang all the letters. I matched them by sound. I used finger spaces. I moved words around. Best of all, let me tell you a secret I found. Writing a sentence is building a tower, block after block, hour by hour. I am a writer, and writing is power.
Wow. I've read that before, but I loved hearing you read it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. And happy Every Day is Poetry Month to all yes. your listeners.
Amy, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today and being our very first guest for the Writing Roundtable. This has been a wonderful episode, and I really thank you for your time and your generosity and all that you give to the writing community.
Thank you so much for having me. It's just a treasure to be a part of your community at Two Writing Teachers.
Thank you for listening to the Two Writing Teachers podcast. Check out the show notes for links to the items we mentioned in this episode, as well as ways to connect with us. For more about the teaching of writing, head over to the Two Writing Teachers blog at twowritingteachers.org. If you liked what you heard today, please share it with your friends and colleagues, post about it on social media, like, subscribe, and leave us ratings and reviews. Our music is by Lemon Music Studio. If you'd like to connect with us, email us at contact@twowritingteachers.org. Thanks again for listening. Let's teach, learn, and write on together.